Good evening and welcome to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric, the only podcast that takes two of your favorite films and makes them go head-to-head in Mortal Kombat for your entertainment. This is episode 9 of season 2. We have the Blues Brothers against That Thing You Do, so sit back and enjoy Box Office Battles.
Hi, I'm Chili Billy, the personality pickle.
Hi, I'm Greg and I'm a nerd.
Aren't you?
I have never seen anything like this.
The worst part has been watching the actual watching of the movie. Some of these were pretty terrible. Well, we are back again. It is Box Office Battles season 2 with Greg and Eric. We're finally back. We've played a lot of hooky this season so far. We're getting there, though. We're gonna
right get about the time that Greg gets over his busted ass eyeball, then the flu hits or AIDS or whatever it was.
A little of both.
Like, listen, that stuff's hard to get over, and no amount of penicillin is gonna help that. So we just had to ride it out. And now, as far as we know, nobody has AIDS. And
as far as we know.
And here we are.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about some movies, Greg.
We are. You know, the thing is it just was the strangest things. You know, of course, I had the eye surgery. We were out for a lot of the holidays, and we just get back. And it's just that time of year. Yes. The wife and I were sick all through Christmas. We had this flu, and my wife had COVID. And then, you know, we try to get back to our, you know, current genre of Box Office Battles. And you were really sick and reached out to me. And I was like, no problem. And then the very next week, I was laid up last week. It was bad. I don't even remember like Tuesday or Wednesday. And it was just a cold. It was just I was taking a lot of NyQuil and just trying to work it through the system. So I was basically drugged myself.
And I got pissed. You texted and you were like, hey, listen, man, I hate to do it, but I'm sick. And I was like, well, I plan my weeks around this shit. What do you mean?
Yeah.
What do you mean sick? Yeah, dude, these kids, they're gross. My kids, they're little. They're in elementary school.
Right.
Two of them are. And yeah, it's that time of year when everybody's gross. Greer's, my 7-year-old's best friend hadn't been at school in a week, you know, got strep throat and then got, I don't know, flu B. And it's like, man, y'all are gross. You can't keep your hands out of your nose and out of your mouth and off of each other's boogers and whatever.
I thought you were going to say something completely different. I was like, dude, I don't know where your kid's going to school.
They go to the Trump Academy. So, nice. You know, they're all grabby.
Just handsy.
But yeah, it's nasty. It's nasty around here. We're about to get some nasty weather down here for the next week. We've got tornado. It's tornado season.
Okay.
I don't know if y'all don't have that. Maybe.
Is that when you go out with your 12 gauges and you hunt tornadoes?
Yeah. Well, it's like the kids are scared and the moms are all watching TV and all the dads are out on the porch with their hands on their hips, just kind of. You know, looking up into the sky, like they know better than this jackass meteorologist, which sounds to me like a completely made up profession.
Sounds like somebody studies meteors.
Yeah. And, or I've got something meteor for you right here, if you know what I mean. And I think that you do.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's everything's gross. Everyone's sick. I'm still got boogers. So if you just hear me tonight going, then just, we'll cut it out in post. Do we have somebody that does that for us?
Yeah, yours truly. So I'll make sure.
All right. I'm glad we hired you.
I make sure I'll leave yours in. But for all those that, you know, listen strictly to the podcast, you know, this is why we've not had a new episode in a while. But we hope to remedy that. We'll try to speed things up a little bit if we can. Get sure. through this current genre and go to into the next one so that we can make up some of the episodes we lost. If our schedule allows, we're going to play it by ear and see what we can do.
I see nothing but smooth sailing on our horizon.
that's generally how it works. So anyway, just want to welcome everybody to the show. If you're listening to us on any of the podcast providers, Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and so many others, thank you for tuning in. Make sure you share the podcast. We appreciate you listening to us and bumping up our numbers. So continue to do that, please. If you want to, you can always email us with your questions and comments at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. You can always follow us and watch the live stream on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod. And you can always watch the live stream on Facebook, our Facebook page. Make sure you go out there and like that. And on YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast. There's something all right with you.
Why does my hand look so huge?
You're like blurry. I think your video, you've got some sort of filter on. At least you're not a cat.
Well, that's not going to make my hand giant.
It's something, you're blurry and not blurry. I mean, I could do the same thing. I mean, if I put my hand, it's called perspective.
It's like no shit.
It's called perspective.
Man, I don't know. That was fucking freaking me out. But I just ordered a bunch of gummies, too, so I might have something to do.
Maybe that's why you're blurry. I have no idea. That could be the reason. But
I just turned on a filter because I thought I look best in soft focus.
Okay.
I'm going to turn the blur intensity down. You tell me when to stop.
Until you're completely blurry.
Well, it was already at 100.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. No, it looks good. You're fine.
Whatever.
I don't think you're going to mess with anybody out there.
I don't give a shit.
But, yeah. So, it is good to be back. We haven't talked in, well, other than by text for the last few weeks, so it's good to see your face and being able to get back into this category. We've been out for a little bit, and tonight, like I mentioned, we have two, I think, really good films. Eric and I have talked a little bit offline, and he thinks one of these is a piece of shit, and I know which one he thinks it is, and we're going to fight, so you're going to have a good time tonight if you're watching the live stream. But tonight, we have the Blues Brothers going up against That Thing You Do, and let's see where they shake out in this bracket. Is right over here in the bottom right. We've got those. We have a number 3 seed, Blues Brothers, and a number 6 seed, That Thing You Do. Of course, we've already had Almost Famous, the 2 seed, get through, and the 1 seed, This Is Spinal Tap, has gotten through.
I think this is the first time that our two top seeds have both got through on the first round.
I'll take your
word. I think we've had an up. I don't listen. I said I think. I think that's what happens. You know,
I don't think have a box
dinosaurs
office.
Were put here to trick us into not believing the Bible. So, you know, I can think what I want, Greg. And I think this is the first time that number 1 and number 2 both made it through in the first round.
We don't have a box office battles historian, so I can't confirm or deny that. So
we should hire one named Greg Lee.
Yeah, I know, right? I have to go back and rewatch all of our episodes and see.
Oh, gross.
The statistician on every single one. But this is where we're at. We've got one other battle left than this, and we'll get to our final 4. So right now, we are getting there. We're going to finish this. I promise we're going to finish this category. But tonight, we're going to talk about That Thing You Do and the Blues Brothers and compare and contrast and decide which of these two films deserves to move on in the tournament. You guys have been voting on our Facebook page. There was a winner there by a slim margin, and so that may come into play tonight. We'll find out.
But was first, it really a slim margin?
It was.
Because only 3 people voted?
No, so there was more than 3 people.
2-1? We've been gone so long that Mike in Florida bailed on the chat on us. He's not participating.
Well,
anymore.
That's a shame.
Yeah, that sucks.
Did he say why?
You pissed him off.
Oh, that's probably something that I'm used to doing. I've been meaning to get with him about being on for our next category.
He's mad about that too.
Is he? Did he tell you that?
I mean, we don't talk a lot or ever, but I'm just assuming. We have to start with the lower seed.
We correct? Do, which is That Thing You Do.
Which is weird. This should be the number 3 seed.
Well, it isn't.
Okay. I need, before we get into this, well, it's because you set the bracket, first of all.
Yeah, we do that based on IMDb score and kind of popularity, box office, based on other ranked sites and everything like that. So, yeah.
IMDb. Schmyimdb, if you know what I mean.
I hear you.
So listen.
Yes.
Are we trying to figure out which movie has the best band in it, or are we just trying to figure out which of these is the best movie?
Well, it's the genre. Every time we do box office battles, it's about the best or the worst movie in case of when we do the bad movies. So it's always the movie. The topic has to be movies about bands that didn't really exist.
Okay.
So they can be they have to be fictional bands.
It's not going to change my vote at the end, but I just wanted to make sure that we were on the same page.
Yeah, so it's really what you think is the better movie of the two is what you should vote for. And okay. These are two.
Do you want me to go ahead and vote?
No, we'll wait till the end. We'll wait till the end. Or we could wrap this up right now.
Yeah, okay, well.
we could just move right on.
Tell me how the audience voted.
Not even explain. Yep.
No, so, the explaining is the most funnest part. So exactly. That thing you do.
Yes.
And I guarantee you what I'm about to say, you're about to say for the Blues Brothers. But this movie came out in 1996. Mm-hmm. I graduated from high school in 1996. I was in a show choir at my high school in 1995 to 1996. This song was everywhere. This movie, although from what I'm reading, didn't do particularly well at the box office, but everybody I knew this movie and had seen this movie, and I've seen this movie, I mean, probably a top 10 most watched movie for me, but I think it's one of those movies. I mean, first of all, so it's a Tom Hanks film, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, for sure. Directed it.
And so he wrote it, and it's like Tom Hanks, in addition to being a really incredible, you know, starts out as a comedy actor, then becomes a really good drama actor, and his whole career, like it's really interesting and kind of constantly building upon itself, and he's reinventing himself. But he writes and directs this movie, and it is the quintessential Tom Hanks feel mm-hmm. of a movie. And it's got all of the, which is interesting because he kind of plays the foil and he's not the antagonist per se, but he plays a very just kind of matter of fact, this is how the business is, sorry, I don't make the rules,
right,
type guy. But the sensibility of That Thing You Do, I mean, you trace it right back to the mind of Tom Hanks and the talent of Tom Hanks. And for me, it's almost like a love story to the 60s one-hit wonder when you could get an acetate made and send it off to your radio station and they might play it, you know? Mm-hmm. And the regional circuits of, you know, what was being played in the Northeast might not have been what was being played in the Southwest. And it's in that they had separate charts for these areas, and it was like, yeah, like to me, this is, like I said, a love story to the anything's possible 60s garage band, one hit wonder. And I find it, this movie, to be charming as hell.
I don't disagree with you. I think it's a fantastic film. I think it's put together. So I will say this, when I first watched it back in the 90s, I did not find it to be very deep. I found it to be very almost saccharine-like in a way, because sure. it's a very easy movie to put on. You know, mm-hmm. you've got your typical all-American lead and Guy Patterson, played by Tom Everett Scott, which interestingly enough is kind of a Tom Hanks lookalike. I read in the trivia that Tom didn't want to cast Tom Everett Scott because he looks so much like a young Hanks, but Rita Wilson, his wife, convinced him to do so because she said he was cute. I wonder why she thought that.
Yeah, reminds me of a younger you.
Exactly. But, you know, he's kind of this guy that's into jazz. He's into more complex music, and an opportunity presents itself when, hilariously played by Giovanni Ribisi, the drummer of one of the local bands in his town, breaks his arm, and Guy ends up getting a chance to play drums. And it's one of those things where you see this in different biopics, either real or I said biopic. I didn't say
I know. I appreciate it.
I'm trying not to say biopic. Although, since we discussed that, I will say this as a sidebar. I keep hearing both versions now. I got my ears open, and I hear other people on the news and everything say biopic. That's where
no,
I kind
they
of
don't.
Up.
You're making that up.
I'm going to put together a montage. I'm going to find
hope that
it.
You
it's
do.
Out there. But there's
I
actually stories about people saying I'm not the only one that says biopic. But anyway, back to what we're saying, biopic. But in a lot of biopics, you have this rags to riches storyline, whether they're real true stories about musical bands, or in this case, a fictional one where, you know, the drummer comes in, they form the band, they get their record made, you know, that gets played, and then they start rising through the charts and everything and rise to stardom. And in this case, it's a one-hit wonder, but it has that element. So I want to say that when I first saw it, I don't think I really paid that much attention to it as an artistic film other than it was a fun film. It's a film that you can throw on Saturday afternoon, and it's very inoffensive. It's nostalgic. It yeah. has, you know, does really well with, like, the painting of the small town USA, his father's electronics store, that whole thing. It does a really great job with setting the scene and getting that vibe. And what I appreciate watching it now was how a lot of the artists were fictional, but they still had the essence of the early 60s music, much more than Eddie and the Cruisers did when we watched
Absolutely.
That a few yeah. weeks ago.
So, it all felt very period appropriate.
Yeah, but I will say this. I watched the director's cut of this time around, and I actually appreciated it more as what Tom Hanks was trying to do. I think maybe it's because I'm older, and I kind of got that Hanks was looking to kind of to write that love letter to a time that was much simpler. But he also has a lot to say that I didn't really pick up on in the 90s when I first watched it. And one of the things was the fact that you got the whole Oneaters thing when they're coming up with the name, and it's the Wonders. It's not by mistake they're called the Wonders with O-N-E, because he is talking about how the one-hit wonders could come into that system and get chewed up. And the name yeah. was basically irrelevant. Everybody kept getting it wrong, but the name itself was a clue that this was not going to be a big band. And when they finally do change it to the Wonders with a W, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And that was just one of many little things that I noticed that I thought were actually done really artistically well in this film.
Yeah, I agree with you. And your earlier point about it being very saccharine and very middle of the road, I agree with that. And it's not challenging at all. And as you were saying that, I was kind of thinking of this movie in the same way I think about Legally Blonde. Like you said, inoffensive. It's got enough moments to keep your attention, but you don't have to pay attention. This is definitely one that if I saw it on while I was folding laundry, I would just put it on. You know, why not watch that thing you do for 20, 30 minutes?
For sure.
So I agree with that. I didn't watch the director's cut of this. So this idea of the one hit wonder, and it's not, obviously it's not limited to the 60s. I think we're going to start seeing that more because there's such a lower barrier to entry into music now with everything being online. So, you know, the odds of just somebody having a hit song, that's great. But I have read before, and I forget who the quote is attributed to, but they said, you know, you have your whole life to write your first album and write your first hit song. It's like, you only have a year to write your second album. And for so many people, you know, first album. I mean, listen, Boston, if you buy their first album, you've bought 99% of listenable Boston tunes right there.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the way it is for a lot of people. Their sophomore effort just isn't what it is. And we see this partly in this movie, but also because the lead singer never, ever wanted this to be a pop, you know, little ditty for teenagers, right? He was a serious songwriter. He was a ballad writer without the ability. Yeah, what's his name? What's the actor's name? Thomas
S-C-A-C-H. Jonathan Skate. I was actually looking at that beforehand. Here's the thing. I have never seen... I will say this, to be honest, I don't like this actor. There was something about his face, both the first time I watched it and this time, that was off-putting to me. Not that he's an ugly dude. It was just, I don't know. I think it was the arrogance that he plays the character. And granted, he's supposed to, but there's very little likability in the character Jimmy that he plays. And it was kind of...
Well, it's not supposed to be likable.
I mean, I know, but...
If anything, somewhat. He is the... Like antagonist of this.
Yeah.
And so his name is also Jonathan, but it's J-O-H-N-A-T-H-O-N.
What the fuck are y'all doing?
You know, and listen, my kids have weird names too, but like, don't call him Bruce and spell it B-R-E-W-C-E. Like, just stick to the basics, you dick. Yeah, I mean, he's a dickhead.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of artists who take themselves very seriously, and this isn't what I wanted to do. They take their art very seriously, as you should, right? It's important. But to not be able to see the forest for the trees and go, I've got my whole life to write whatever song that no one's going to listen to, you know, ahead of me. Ride this out. Make every penny you can doing this and then go do that. And I think that I found that really frustrating.
Yeah.
While I'm watching the movie and just going, everybody wants to be this and do this and you've got it. And it's just, it's not good enough for my serious music sensibilities.
And what's so funny is that he continues to want to write ballads. But yet it's Guy who is the one who really knows music. He knows mm-hmm. the jazz musicians. He studies them. The scene where they go to the jazz radio station, I found it really hilarious because it's basically just a conversation between him and the DJ. They just keep talking about the jazz music and stuff like that and what's going on. And I found that pretty fascinating that Guy knew more about music, and it really wasn't until Guy gets into the group that things start to fall into place.
Mm-hmm.
They really were kind of floundering. I mean, they had a really bad drummer, but still, besides that, so it makes more sense. And so, Jimmy is just one of these characters that he holds his own value way too high and to the detriment of the band. He may be a good singer, maybe a good guitar player, but as a band leader, no one follows him. He's just not a class act. Yeah, on that was to be interesting.
I mean, you're right. That's absolutely right. I mean, look at the rest of this cast. We are in 1996, so we are at prime Eric Dillo being madly in love with Liv Tyler.
Yeah.
I mean, geez. And so here she is in this, Charlize Theron.
Yep, Charlize Theron. She has a really interesting role because it's not one of these standard... You know, you've got this thing where she's a guy's girlfriend in the beginning, and she continually is cheating on him with this dentist. But it doesn't ever really matter. Well,
does the director's cut give us any more of that?
They show him going out on dates. They go to to play golf at the driving range, and you basically just get this whole thing where she's moved on. There's never any breakup. It's just she just stopped communicating. Which is weird for a movie. You think that they introduce this character, they have this relationship, he goes off to do music, she doesn't really give a shit about any of his music, and she basically hooks up with the dentist. It was like her character really didn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Had she not even had a girlfriend, it would have been irrelevant, in my opinion.
Yeah, we've had that come up on a few movies we've watched before, that we got so confused about why take up any bandwidth of this movie on something that you're not going to follow through with.
Yeah.
We call that, or they call that, right, Chekhov's gun. Like, don't put a gun on the table if no one's going to use that gun.
Yeah. In a standard film, it just cliched wise or trope wise, they would have made it big. And after she cheated on him with the dentist, she would have showed up after he has feelings for Liv Tyler and said, "This is my man. I'm back," even though she dumped him or whatever. And then it would create this, you know, triangle between the three of them. But they don't go there, which is fine. I mean, it's refreshing that they don't, but it also makes her character very irrelevant. I mean, in the director's cut, I don't know how much is in and what, because I can't remember the differences, but I know they show a lot of her with the dentist, and it really didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It's just her going out with this other guy.
I think the big scene stealer here.
Yeah.
I know you know who I'm going to say.
Oh, of course.
Man, and it's like every movie he's in, if it's big part, small part, like Steve Zahn,
yep.
I think is, I mean, maybe he is rated. Maybe I'm not in the, you know enough to know where he sits in, you know, the order hierarchy of actors and actresses. But every time I see Steve Zahn, I'm like, okay, like, show me what you got. Cause it's always great. And it's no different in this movie. He is hilarious.
Yeah.
He's like off the wall and just, I think it's, besides Tom Everett Scott, I think it's the best performance in the movie, and it's not a lot, but it's scene stealing. I mean, how many times do we see that from him?
If you're a Steve Zahn fan, if you know his name, then you're a fan. If you know his name, if you've seen him in things and you go, oh, it's that guy. But if you know his name, then you're a Steve Zahn fan, because you've seen him crop up and he always brings a smile to your face. I remember him in Saving Silverman with Jack Black and the guy from American Pie, Jason Biggs. A great film, decent comedy, but he makes it, elevates it. I actually just watched him in the new Anaconda with Jack Black and Paul Rudd. Not the greatest film. It's okay.
You don't say.
It's got some laughs in it. It's meant to be, you know, a kind of a meta take on the Anaconda franchise. And it has laughs in it. But I tell you what, Steve Zahn, it was worth watching it just for Steve Zahn to see him again in something, because I hadn't seen him in anything for a while. So, yeah, he has the moments. Without him, there's probably not many laughs in this film. He carries most of the laughter in this film. Most of the humor is done by Steve Zahn.
I have an important announcement to make.
Okay. All right.
You and I are 2 degrees of separation from Steve Zahn.
How does that work?
Steve Zahn was the voice of Swampy in 3 episodes of the children's animated series Phineas and Ferb.
Oh.
Of which our mutual friend, Jarrett the Carrot Reddick, does the theme song.
Interesting.
Yeah. So all we have to do is just call Jarrett. He likes being called unannounced.
Yeah.
And then just, we could have had him on. I bet we could have had Steve Zahn on.
Yeah, probably. I mean, they may know each other.
I like Steve Zahn. And do you ever watch the Righteous Gemstones?
Yes.
Okay. I liked him. I like him in Righteous Gemstones.
Yep.
I'm just looking at his IMDb here. Yeah. Cause 2001 was Saving Silverman.
Yes. Fantastic. It's a lot of fun. I love the fact that they're Neil Diamond impersonators, and he's so good in it. And so that one stood out for me, but he's another one. Him and his friend have to masquerade as gay lovers.
I could do that.
And I can't remember the name of it. It was a really good, really good movie.
Which one of the two of us do you think could pull off being in a gay relationship better? I think it's you.
Thank you. I'm not sure.
See me in the morning as I walk out. Hello, world. As I wake my kids up and they're just like, what the fuck? Like, it's morning. It's early. I get these kids up at 6:30 to go to school. I don't remember ever getting up to go to school at 6:30. And they just look at me like, why are you acting that way at 6:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
You want to know why, Greg?
Why?
Because every day is a great day when you don't wake up dead. You know what I mean?
That is true.
So let's get to it.
So,
I take it back. I think I'd be a better gay masquerader.
I don't know.
I'm not trying to insult you. You wouldn't be as good at it as I am.
I have dressed in drag before, and I will say, when I was in high school, I was a sexy bitch when I dressed in drag.
Someone mark that, and let's just pull that audio for later.
I was.
Put it on our drop board.
I would have fucked me. But anyway.
You probably did.
In front of a mirror. No, it was, I did for a high school thing. We dressed up in drag for a mother-daughter banquet, and a bunch of us guys in the high school dressed up as characters from the Pirates of Penzance and went out and did a song. I forget the song, but we lip-synced to it, and we were all in drag. But it was a lot of fun. But the movie...
Yeah, sounds like you
before
boys
we get completely really derailed.
Having a ball.
The movie that I'm thinking of is Happy Texas. So if you've never seen that with Steve Zahn, William H. Macy is in it. It's a very, very funny film. Happy Texas with Steve Zahn. Three prisoners escape. Two end up in Happy Texas where they're mistaken for a gay couple expected there to help with the small girl's beauty pageant. It's so really good.
How old are...
1999 was when that came out.
Okay. Yeah.
Miramax. So it was kind of more on the independent side. So
Happy Texas.
Yeah.
That was right after he did You've Got Mail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But
not M-A-L-E.
No, that's a whole different movie. But yeah, there's so many great scenes. I love the scene with this one here that we've got on the screen with the girl who's trying to clearly hit on guy, and he leaves and then he
bails out.
He keeps trying to swoop in on the women, and it's not like he's the bass player who doesn't even have a name in the film. He is a guitar player. He's one of the leads, and yet he takes it. He struggles so hard to find a woman, and then when he does, he marries her right away in Vegas. He does a great job in the film.
Yep. He's great. You know, I don't know. It's not like, let me look at this. So it's rated a 7 on IMDb. Mm-hmm. And that's honestly probably right. I have told people when I was doing the last show, and I've said it on this show, it's like when I watched the Blues Brothers for the first time.
Yes.
For this podcast.
That's crazy.
I mean, I had seen bits and pieces of it, but so I am not beholden to how you felt about this movie when you were a kid and how it affected you. Then I'm watching it with a clean slate,
mm-hmm.
48 years old, all of the combined experiences of my life turning me into the shithole of a person I am today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I often accuse people, and rightly so, of kind of holding that sentimentality, kind of attaching it to the movie and not being able to separate it out.
Yeah.
And I do get the sense that I probably am guilty of doing that for this movie,
mm-hmm.
because, like I said, it came out when I was 17 or 18, and it's just comforting. It's just low impact. It's just fun enough to be interesting. It's a subject matter that I find really interesting. You know, if it were about comic book writers who have one big comic book hit, that wouldn't resonate with me the same way that being in a garage band does. So I bet a rating of 7 out of 10 is probably appropriate for this. Anything higher, you start getting into some films that are challenging and films that are art and films, you know, this isn't challenging. It's not art per se. Yeah. Anything higher than a 7, you start to get into films that are more important, have more going on, have more of a plot, have more artistic merit, have more you know, and so, yeah, that's probably right. I just have a hard time, like most people do, separating out my sentimentality from that thing you do. This movie is a really, like I said, the original Star Wars trilogy, Moulin Rouge, Good Will Hunting, I guarantee, Shawshank Redemption and Legally Blonde, I guarantee you those are the movies that I've seen the most times, whether or not they're my favorite, and they are, but even if they were, I've seen those the most. I guarantee you that thing you do is in that next tier of movies that I've seen dozens of times.
That's interesting, yeah. So I was I was 25 when this came out, and we just, it was a rental for us, and watched it at the house, and it was just what it was. I was a Tom Hanks fan. I've always been since I was young. In fact, I can go back to remember watching Tom Hanks on Bosom Buddies.
Bosom Buddies, yeah.
Where they played the him and Peter Scolari, who is in the film.
In the movie.
Yeah, he plays the host of the television show near the end of the film, which is nice that Tom Hanks, you know, threw him in there. The late, great Peter Scolari, who Buffy and Hildegard were on with the names of the two women that Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari dressed up as so they could live in the woman's hotel. If you've never seen Bosom Buddies, it's Tom Hanks before he was really Tom Hanks. And he passed away a few years ago, Peter Scolari did. But yeah, so I go back that far with Tom Hanks.
Thanks for breaking the news on the show.
There you go. Spoiler.
Bumming everybody out.
but so we were at that age, that time period in the 90s. Remember, like every year another Tom Hanks film came out.
Yeah.
Whether it was Castaway, whether it was whatever, it was just a steady stream. Philadelphia, everything was Tom Hanks. It was
the feel good movie of the year.
Every movie was Tom Hanks. So this one was no different, so we put it on. It's surprising that he doesn't come in till much later, but it's clear that he's not the star of the film. The focus is on the band.
Yeah.
But I you know, we just enjoyed it. And I'll be honest, I don't think I watched it since the 90s. I think I may have caught, like you said with Blues Brothers, maybe caught pieces of it, just that it's on. But I never went out of my way to say, oh, I'm going to watch this again. No offense to it. I didn't dislike it. It was just that it was never a standout. That being said, I would probably be more likely to watch it again after this last viewing because there was more I got out of it. One of the things that I wanted to point out, I pointed out earlier, there's so many little things that are very subtle that Tom Hanks does in this film that make a point that I appreciate as a movie fan. The song, That Thing You Do, which is the only real hit they have, is played over and over and over a total of 11 times in the film. And I turned to my wife in the middle of it. I said, this is not by accident. They're making you sick of this song, which happens with a lot of one-hit wonders. They saturate one-hit wonders. They milk them dry. Yeah. And you see in the film that the wonders are being milked dry. They keep asking when we're going to record again. And they keep getting fluffed off to the next show. And Tom Hanks's job is not to get them back in the studio. It's to continue to ride this wave of this one song.
Yeah.
And then when they get in the studio, we want another one just like it. And and I turned to my wife and I said, remember in the 90s around this time, Hanson with Umbop. Now they've gone on to other things, but everybody just knows them for Umbop. And it was played over and over and over until you got to the point where you didn't even want to hear it anymore. And then they were done with it. And then you kind of, Hanson never reached that height again because they were a part of that system where it's like, we're going to keep milking this. And I noticed that Hanks in the movie is playing That Thing You Do ad nauseum. I've never seen a movie where one song in the musical is played that much. Could you imagine any other film that is a musical? What if Frozen just sang Let It Go 11 times in the movie?
I mean, that's the worst song in that movie anyway.
I'm just saying, if they did that, it would drive people insane. And that's the point.
Okay, it's wild. I had never thought about that, but like creating that fatigue for the song as you're watching it as an audience member, that kind of works in parallel to the fatigue.
It's a brilliant
that
choice
they would get from playing it. You know, at the end, Tom Hanks says, "You're going to record another album. You're going to record that thing you do in Spanish.
Yeah.
You're going to, you know, like."
That's so, all they wanted was they wanted that thing you do over and over and over again. And that's all record executives really care about. And that's where Tom Hanks really comes in. He never cares about the band. And I, you know, there's a lot of parallels to the Beatles in this movie. And that's kind of, if you go online, you can see all the different parallels that are, that you can compare the Beatles' rise to the Wonders' rise. But the difference is Tom Hanks's character is no Brian Epstein. Brian Epstein, when he took over the Beatles, he cared about them, cared about their music. And his theory was, let's keep, before this song fades away, let's hit him with another one. That's why the Beatles had so many songs in the top 10 at once, because Epstein didn't believe in just one hit played over and over. He believed, like, as soon as this, just on the verge of people getting sick of it, we're going to hit him with something else. And that was the antithesis of what he did compared to the other record executives in the 60s, especially, that just were looking, like we talked about, just that one group that could come in, do one single, and get out.
Well, and the Beatles fell apart when he died.
They did, yeah.
And they lost their father figure, the only person who kind of could keep them singularly focused as much as you could, those four guys. And yeah, I mean, when he died, you know, it wasn't too long after that where they just kind of tore themselves apart. And so what else? So you said there were a couple of other things that you noticed from the director's cut or.
But yeah, in the director's cut, one of the things that's clearly different is that Tom Hanks is homosexual. His character, there's a scene where Howie Long pulls up at outside of the hotel in a tuxedo, and he's upset that Tom Hanks has not come out yet. And he mentions his name to the band, he introduces him, and then he gets in the car and leaves with Howie Long. And that's just one thing. You're like, oh, okay, what was that about? Then later, when they meet Buzz Aldrin, played by Bryan Cranston, of all people.
Yeah.
They meet Buzz Aldrin. He actually asks if Buzz can call Howie Long's character. He's just going to love it. He's just going to love it, which is, you know, so there's no homosexual scenes with him, but it's clearly implied in the director's cut that A. White, you know, the Hanks character is gay, which is just, I mean, it's just there. And I think that was another one of the parallels, because Brian Epstein was gay. So that was one of the many parallels between them and the Beatles that I think that Tom Hanks was going for. Some of the others, just real quick, the drummer swap. The Beatles were nothing with Pete Best until Ringo came in, which is what Guy does. The bassist change with Stuart Sutcliffe was the original bassist, and then he died. In this case, the bass player ends up going to Vietnam, and he ends up being replaced by Wolfman. So, yeah, so there's several parallels. The Jimmy stands.
You think he's going to know our songs?
Yeah, good moment. But yeah, Jimmy stands like purposefully like John did in front of the mic and sings like that. So there was a lot of things that Tom Hanks was really attributing to the Beatles, but there is that contrast, whereas they were a one-hit wonder, the Wonders were. The Beatles had longevity, which it shows you. And I think it does. It gave me a lot to think about the machine that is the recording industry. I think my wife and I talked about for like 15, 20 minutes after the film was how Spotify is today. Ugh. And how artists get like one penny per stream off of these things, and how the record industry has not changed at all. It's all about what they can use and what the labels can use artists for. I mean, Jarrett, you know, our friend knows this more than anybody else, but he had to go through with the record label situation, the way things are. And I think that he's probably in a much better place being able to produce things the way he does now that have to constantly deal with record executives. It's just a cutthroat business. It really is.
Yeah. The thing is that you're not in a position of negotiating power. I mean, if you're not willing to do it, then step aside. There's the line forms to the left of bands that, you know, want to be famous.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, don't really either care or don't think about the fact that they're getting ripped off, that, you know, you are the talent. And yes, the record company is the infrastructure. But without you, they're nothing. You know, you can do what they do. They can't do what you do.
No.
But that gets lost because I think that the glamour of being a rock and roll star, of being famous, but, you know, sadly, more bands than not. And so we see this at the end of the movie when they say you're in breach of contract. And, you know, bands used to get, you know, fronted some amount of money. If they don't make it back, it's kind of like you owe that to the record company forever. They're not going to come sue you for it, but you do owe it. And they kind of hint at that at the end of this film. And Tom Hanks is the one that has to say, it's fine. Like, y'all broke up. You had one hit. You broke up. He's on to the next one. He knows the reality, the harsh reality of the business, of the dozens that came before and the hundreds that'll come after of the one hit wonder. You know, like, and they do a good job of showing this in the film too, sending these guys off to do the Iowa State Fair.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Whatever. Like, it's not glamorous for 90% of these guys, mm-hmm. you know? And even when it is glamorous, it's only glamorous for a while because with a few exceptions, the people who put out 10, 15 albums over 20, 30 years are the vast minority compared to three albums called it quits, two albums called it quits, one album called it quits. And, you know, so even when your star is as high as it's ever going to be, it is fleeting. And the next thing you know, you're either back to playing the Iowa State Fair. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. If I could make exactly what I make at my, you know, boring desk job, you know, I mean, I guess if it didn't mean being away from my family, but like, right. I was thinking the other day, like, let's just say you made $300,000 this year taking your band around to state fairs. Like, that'd be kind of fun, yeah, right?
Not bad at all. I would take $120,000 for
that. Right. I mean, so there's nothing, you know, I don't want people to think that I'm shitting on the bands that you see playing the Saturday afternoon at your local arts festival or whatever, where I saw a Flock of Seagulls before on a Sunday afternoon playing for maybe 40 people, you know, I don't, that's great. Do that. But what I'm saying is that when you're selling out arenas for that 6 months to a year and everything that comes after that never, ever, ever measures up to that, it's got to feel a little defeating. It's easy for me to say, well, I would love to do that because I'm sitting here. I'm not, I've never been at the height of anything.
Right.
Ever. Nothing. So there's nothing to come down off of and be disappointed by. You know, to me, it all, I think the same thing when I watch basketball and I'm like, you know, you could pay me $849,000 a year to be the 12th man on the bench who averages 4 minutes a game.
Yeah.
Don't you think I could do that? Don't you think I could go out there for 1 minute? 1 minute?
Maybe.
And just chuck one up every night? They're not going to put me in there game 7 of the finals. Like,
But the thing is that the spots are so limited. Like when these guys have this dream in high school or even in middle school of becoming a pro athlete, there are so few spots, 0.0001%. Yep. Of all athletes that get a chance to play professionally. And maybe a little bit wider for musicians. Musicians, even if they don't make it, at least can play gigs and at least do what they want in front of an audience and at least do something. And I think that's kind of the message of the Wonders, is that when all is said and done, you know, guy goes off and he plays a little bit of jazz, he gets the girl, which he didn't even expect to in the beginning. The love story is very, you know, sweet in the fact that they never really have this romance until all is said and done, until she's no longer with Jimmy and he's no longer with Charlize Theron. And now it's like, all right, cool. Now we're going to get these two together at the very end of the film. That's refreshing. That's different. But he goes on, Steve Zahn gets married. It kind of catches you up with what everybody did. And Jimmy does music, but he never, you know, will never reach the heights of that thing you do ever again. And it's just the way life is. And I think that's kind of the message that Hanks is going for. It's really tough to make that pinnacle and that leap. And in the music industry itself is more concerned with making money than it is about making music. And for the artist, making music is important, but no one else in the business looks at it that way. It's image and what money you can bring in. I'll finish on one thing, because we talked about the artist making money and owing money. There's a really good documentary. I cannot remember the name of it right now, but you can Google it. It's about 30 Seconds to Mars. And Jared Leto, at the beginning of the film, they're getting ready to make 30 Seconds to Mars' third album. And they go to the record company going, hey, yeah, what's our budget for this? And they go, oh, no, you owe us money. And he immediately turned on the cameras. He immediately said, fuck this, I'm making a movie. And then he immediately told his record company, we're no longer with you. And they began a long legal battle. And the third album, they decided they were going to do on their own, because they could not believe as many records as they had sold, that they owed money for all the advances that they were given. It's a ridiculous business. So I love the music industry, but again, it's so funny, because one of the things they say is, they, at the end of the film, spoiler alert, at the end of the film, Jared Leto stands up and he asks the audience at the concert, because that's where you really make their money, and they have a full sold out arena, how many of you pirated this album? And almost the entire audience cheers yes. And, you know, they just, and then he goes like, fuck yeah. Because he's like, we don't make anything off of somebody buying the digital album. They don't make anything off of the streams. It's coming to the shows, buying the merchandise. And if they self-produce, buying it that way. So, yeah, it's a really good movie. I recommend it if you want to see something a little bit about it. Even if you like 30 Seconds to Mars and you want to see something about the music industry. But that brings
Jared has been nice enough to hook a couple of my friends up with tickets, you know, around the, my corporate office is in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And so I've got friends over there who wanted to go see a show. He put them on the list. Who does he know in Baltimore? Right.
Yeah.
But I told them, I'm like, then the second you get through the door, I need you both to go buy a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, that's the quid pro quo, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's where they're making their money. And, you know, they're nice enough to, you know, throw in a free ticket. So go buy a shirt.
Yeah. Today's love to an artist is sharing the music, you know, sharing their posts, letting people know what's out there, and, you know, in buying the merch and going to the shows, you know, that you can. That's how you can show your artist love. Music, I mean, if you want to stream it, there's nothing wrong with having a Spotify account and just streaming it. Buying CDs or buying albums. I like having vinyl, so I'll buy vinyl for my own personal collection, but there's no need to really do that.
Do you like tapes or CDs better?
Yeah, I like C&Ds, nuts in your mouth. We've been down that road before. I'm not falling for it again, Mister.
I just wanted to see.
I'm sure you
did. It was an exploratory.
You
want to
see these nuts in your mouth? I'm sure that's what.
I don't want to see them. I just want to feel them.
God gotcha. All right. So that's that thing you do. It's going up against a movie from 1980 that is considered a classic. It's considered iconic. Mm. And it is. You can say what you will. I already hear you going, over there. The Blues Brothers with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. It is 7.9 on IMDb, which is bordering on that 8 level. Yeah. And it is one of these things. When you go back to the beginning of the Blues Brothers. Now, you talk about 1980. I was 9 years old. I wasn't allowed to watch this film when it came out in theaters. Didn't see it in theaters. I think my first time I saw it, I was maybe 13 or 14, just on cable. So I'd never seen the movie in the theater, but I watched it a lot on cable as I grew up. Whenever it came on, had the soundtrack. I had the album's briefcase full of blues. I grew up in a household that listened to a lot of different types of music. Every one of my siblings grew up in a different decade. So I got a basic mishmash of all different types of genres. My oldest sister was a early 60s, and then my next brother was mid, late 60s, 70s, and everything. Blues, jazz, I got it all. And so when I was a kid growing up, I would get their old records. And so I couldn't discern what I wanted, or I would just take it all, whether it was Journey or whether it was Lightning Hopkins. It didn't matter to me.
Yeah.
I would take it all because it was free. They were giving it to me and I was educating myself, whether it was Rolling Stones or Talking Heads. It was just, that was what it was. And, the Blues Brothers was born for the Dan Aykroyd's love of rhythm and blues music. Not so much like the blues of the Delta, No, it's R&B, rhythm and blues, yeah, of the 60s, that era, Stax Records and that kind of thing. He had exposed John Belushi to it, who was his best friend, and came up with the idea of doing this skit in the show, on the Saturday Night Live show, to open up before they did the show. And they would warm up the audience by doing a couple of songs. And it got to the point where the Lorne Michaels wanted them to actually do it on the show. And they dressed them as bees for some weird reason the first time they performed. And for a while it kind of went over, and then eventually they were able to play as the Blues Brothers, Jake and Elwood, on Saturday Night Live, and it became a staple of Saturday Night Live. It became one of those things that they did constantly. So with a lot of things, when something gets that hot, they decide to make this movie. John Landis, a renowned director, came on board to direct it. Dan Aykroyd wrote the screenplay. At one point, it was like 300 pages. John Landis cut it down.
I was going to say, kind of a mess.
cut it down considerably. And then they went out and just asked for favors from most of the music community. And the thing about this movie, I think, that is so well loved about it, it is that snapshot of that late 70s, early 80s artist, especially the rhythm and blues artist of the time. And it does a really good job of showcasing that music and its importance to the fabric of Americana. And it mixes in this tapestry of these oddball characters as the two brothers go on a mission to save the orphanage that they grew up in from being demolished and putting the kids out in the street. And that's just the backdrop of what drives everything in the film. And Eric apparently hates this
movie. Yeah, so... No. I start almost every show saying I hated one of them. And I didn't... Man, this is tough because I'm not sure if I liked it or didn't like it when I got done. Like, I can appreciate the kind of vignettes as we move from one to another, and we see James Brown and we see Cab Calloway and we see Ray Charles and, and Aretha Franklin. And like, I know just from kind of being a musician and the history of music, like, I know Steve Cropper, I know Duck Dunn. Like, these guys are like famous session guys. I appreciate the cameos. I appreciate that it's a tribute to that music. As a film, it felt it felt almost like a series of skits more than it felt like a fully thought out movie. In fact, you know, it's kind of just a caper that I didn't find any uniqueness to much at all. And I think more than that, and I understand that we're supposed to know that these, at least one of these two guys is a total bastard, but it's like really unlikable guy goes through a series of events and is still unlikable at the end. And I never could figure out, like, am I supposed to be rooting for these guys to, like, do this? Because at the end of the day, I'm rooting for these two pieces of shit to be successful.
Interesting.
And I don't know. I
don't think they are meant to be unlikable at all. I think in the context of that era, they were extremely cool. They were guys that in that time frame, and again, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, so I can remember people like this. They, you know, going to jail was no big thing. You know, the robbery stuff and stealing things and everything like that. It was John Belushi being basically John Belushi, or in his case, just morphing into Jake Blues, and Dan Aykroyd being the sidekick brother who was really trying to please him, do everything for him, and get this band back together, which that was the whole essence of it, was getting the band back together and recapturing something that they had before Jake goes to prison. So yeah, I never come off with Jake being unlikable. You know, does he leave Carrie Fisher's character at the altar and she chases them around with an M16 to try to murder them the whole film, and maybe he's partly to blame? Sure. But that's a joke. It's something that's not meant to be taken seriously. It kind of drives, because it's a mystery. Why is this woman trying to blow up where they live? And it's also the absurdist nature of the film. Everything is kind of over the top in a way that you don't take it seriously. In fact, going back to the beginning with the nun, where she takes out starts hitting him with the ruler, Kathleen Freeman, excellent in it. That, and then she kind of glides back into the thing. It sets a tone right off the bat. This movie is not to be taken seriously. It's meant to really just have fun. It's a party type movie. And I think that when it got out there, and that's kind of how Saturday Night Live was, it was just cool. Saturday Night Live, when it came out the first 5 years, just the essence of cool. And that's what this movie was. It was just a way to go to the theater and experience that vibe of this kind of absurdist humor. And like you said, I can see where it comes off as skits, because that's kind of what ties everything together. It's a road movie where they're traveling from location to location, but along the way, they encounter these other individuals that kind of build on the story, but it's all separate skits.
Yeah. And listen, I mean, in 1980, I was 3, and even if I had been 13, my parents weren't going to let me watch this movie. So I understand that I'm not sitting in that frame of reference with that cultural zeitgeist, where Saturday Night Live was new. And not only was it new, but no one was saying, you know, I liked the old Saturday Night Live better than it, because it was new. Like, this was it. This was all of your classic characters and all of your classic comedians that were on the show. So I get that I'm sitting in 2026, past my prime and past where, had I seen this when I was a teenager or in my early 20s in the 1980s, I fully see that it would be different.
Yeah.
For me, it just kind of like, and again, I'm not sure if I dislike this movie. I'm just not real sure I liked it a whole lot. Mm. I didn't feel like I was being punished like some of the movies that we've watched, like Citizen Kane. You know, it's not that. When I start going through my little mental checklist of what are the things that I, you know, I need a character I can root for. I didn't feel that. And I can see that if it was different then, it was different then. But I just thought, so I got to root for two scumbags? Like, this is it?
Yeah.
And I even thought to myself, like, okay, well, maybe it's a redemption story because they're trying to do this for their orphanage. Mm-hmm. What was it? I mean, because they're just as sleazy at the end as they are at the beginning. Yeah. And I got this thought, and I've said it before, like, they're on a mission from God. They're putting the band back together. They're going to save this orphanage.
Yes.
Does not make them good people.
No.
Just like Hitler adopting a dog, you know, doesn't make him a good person, right? So I found that part challenging. I didn't find a character where I was like, okay, I really want it to work out for them.
Right. You know what's interesting? And it that makes sense to me. That makes total sense to me. I can't argue with your opinion on the movie from that standpoint. But what's interesting is growing up in a different attitude toward it. And we're not that far apart in age. Like, see, you were 3. I was 9. I was 9, but I watched it when I was, you know, kind of a preteen teenager when I finally really watched it. But I did watch Saturday Night Live and used to sneak and watch it behind my mom's back. And then when it came in reruns, I'd watch it all the time. I was really obsessed with it when I was younger. I loved the original cast members of Saturday Night Live. But in this film, in the context of 1980, Jake and Elwood are not sleazy. They're actually the norm. They're actually the cool guys in America. And the sleazy ones are everybody they encounter that follows them. The two cops are assholes. The authority figures are not redeemable. You know, the fact that they pull over Jay or Elwood and he's got all these traffic, that's funny to people that he's got all these violations out there. That's the norm of people that were just trying to get by in that era. They probably had a lot of citations out there too. And nobody trusted the police or liked the police in 1980. I think even less than they do today. And so that was a definite type of theme that Elwood and Jake are on the run from the law, who are in the wrong here. And they're trying to stay one step ahead of the law. The rednecks with the racism toward them because of their blues act. And of course, stealing their act, which I think is one of my favorite parts of the film, is when they sing in Bob's Country Bunker. The Nazis that, again, they run over there. Everybody that Jake and Elwood encounter are the bad guys. They are the sleazy ones. And Jake,
I would
and
like
Elwood,
to go on record and say that I did not think that the Nazis were the good guys.
I disagree. I think you
didn't. I have the courage.
You were rooting for the Nazis.
No.
rooting for the Nazis, I think.
I'm the only, between the two of us, I'm the only one with the courage to say that I think being a Nazi is horrible. I've never heard you say that. Not once.
One of my favorite lines of the film, and I used to quote it. You know, this is one of these films that I've watched so many times. Again, we were watching it with my wife, and she literally told me to shut up. 15 minutes in, I'm saying the entire script.
That's like annoying as fuck.
But you can't help it. I'm not saying it loud. I was saying it under my breath. She could see my mouth moving, and I couldn't help it. It was a reflection. I've seen it so many times.
I don't care how quietly you eat. I don't want to hear you eat.
I hear you. So it was one of those things where she had to, all right, stop. I know you've seen the movie 100 times, so stop it. But the one scene that I quote a lot is Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis. It's just one of those moments, and then they run over the Nazis on the bridge and jump them into the water. John Candy, another one I say
I
all
like
the
John
time.
Candy.
Another is, I say it all the time, we'll be at a bar, and back then orange whips were a popular drink in the late 70s, early 80s, as far as this nasty kind of creamsicle type drink. And every time I go to a bar with somebody my age, I'll go, orange whip, orange whip, three orange whips, and people get the joke. They know the line. So it's it goes back to context of the times. Jake and Elwood were perceived as, I don't think they were ever perceived as not being the heroes or unlikable in this. They're lovable in this film in the context that I grew up in. Just the everything that they do is the one-liners are really funny. So they are the kind of the glue that bridge all these musical numbers together. And I think that was the second kind of priority of this film, is to, number one, be funny and create this musical vibe, but also showcase all of these artists. Because what you notice and what I love is that outside of the Blues Brothers solo numbers, when another artist appears, they do not sing a duet with that artist. They let, except for Ray Charles, but even then, they're just dancing with him. They don't take over his song. They don't take over Aretha Franklin's song. It's all, you know, theirs. You know, you're letting them be them. And it makes a difference. I think that they want to showcase those artists. The Ray Charles music, I love that scene. I think it's one of the best choreographed. It's just, you see Ray Charles at probably one of his prime moments. The song's great, and the whole number is one of my favorites of the whole film.
There's debates that are not worthwhile about, Rolling Stone will have their top 100 guitarists of all time or vocalists or whatever it is. But I think most people that you ask, top three vocalists, most people are going to have Freddie Mercury in there. You'll have some Steve Perry's and, some other guys. For me, it's Ray Charles. And I mean, it's not even close. It's unique. It's the style of music I like. I think Freddie Mercury, I know that he had a very opera-based background, and so that came out in a lot of, what Queen, the music product that was being put out. But when I just think of, it's unique, it's the style of music I like, and it can punch you right in the guts. And isn't that kind of like what we listen to music for, to kind of like get punched in the guts every now and then? I think Ray Charles is like an otherworldly talent.
I
loved that part.
Yeah. What did you think of the individual musical numbers? The James Brown number in the church is, I think, stellar.
I thought it was great. I think James Brown is a like landmark artist who basically like invented an entire genre of music, kind of coming out of R&B into like that funk type thing. No one was doing that.
Yeah.
Until he came along.
Aretha Franklin scene.
Aretha Franklin scene was great. As a collection of musical numbers, I don't think there was one on there. I liked, what's the Cab Calloway song?
Oh, Minnie the Moocher.
Minnie the Moocher.
Yeah.
I like that. I loved watching them play Stand By Your Man at the country bar.
Oh, that's
like
that's
I liked as a series of musical performances, in the same way that I like The Last Waltz as a series of musical performances.
Right.
But I don't consider The Last Waltz to be a good movie, quote unquote.
Yeah.
To me, it's a documentary about the last night that the band played, and on Thanksgiving night, whenever that was. And I get to see Neil Young, and I get to see Eric Clapton. I get to see, all of these guys play Bob Dylan. And so I guess I just have a hard time calling this, obviously it's a movie, but I just mean, I have a hard time appreciating it as a movie when it just feels like it kind of got bookended with, oh shit, we need a reason for all of these musical numbers to happen. Oh shit, all of the musical numbers are over, so this has to be the end of it. How do we end this thing? And in between, just a pretty generic, and not that it wasn't funny at parts, but a fairly straightforward caper movie, or trying to get away from the cops and trying to get away from the Nazis and trying to get away from the cowboy band or you know, whatever they're called.
All simultaneously at the end, yeah.
I don't know. Just kind of fell flat for me.
Yeah, I can see
but
that.
Again, I'm almost 50. I'm watching this movie for the first time, and I'm just kind of like, meh.
Yeah, you know. So the thing is one of the things I do, like where you see it strung together and it doesn't kind of, it isn't cohesive, I find it to be structured in a beautiful way with, because all the skits, if you will, are all tied together in a really good linear pattern. And it's almost like the old Westerns, like the Magnificent Seven or a heist film, where they're getting the band back together one member at a time, and each one to get that band member, like when they get Blue Lou and Mac Guitar Murphy from Aretha Franklin, they have to go there, and then they have to get her away from Aretha Franklin, getting the instruments, and then arranging the actual show at the Palace Hotel Ballroom, and then getting that, and then culminating with kind of there's like almost two climaxes to the film. The actual show, which is fantastic with the two full musical numbers, and then the car chase scene, which they wrecked 103 automobiles in that, which was the record at the time. And it was very ambitious, practical stunts, no CGI, just crazy guitar chase scenes. You know, the car, the Nazi car that falls into the street, that from the when they jump off the building, was an actual vehicle that they dropped from a helicopter. So all practical effects to these things to kind of pull off these stunts. And every time I've watched it, I'm not saying I'm disappointed in you, but I'm just saying that I've watched. Well, this is a very beloved film for me, and there's so many reasons why I love it. I find it hilarious from start to finish. I find the humor to be kind of acerbic, sarcastic, but also just grounded in kind of a realism base between the two brothers growing up. I find all the guest appearances to just be amazing. One of the things, I have the extended cut of this, and all the musical numbers are longer, so I'll watch it with a few drinks and just enjoy the music. I'm a big fan, like we mentioned earlier, of Donald Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper that you see in this image. And then you've got, and I'm going to talk about the guy in the bottom right. There's three guys here. There's Blue Lou Marini, who is the saxophone player, Mr. Fabulous, who plays the trumpet, and Tom Bones Malone on the trombone. Just an amazing band that they put together that they stole from like the Stax and Volt label. These guys, Donald Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper, were part of Booker T and the MGs that had the hit Green Onions, but they were also the backing band for so many major artists of the 60s. They were the house band. They played with Sam and Dave. Mm-hmm. And my personal favorite is Otis Redding, and these guys played with Otis Redding. They went on tour with Otis Redding. And so they have this lineage of this great rhythm and blues. And as far as Tom Bones Malone, the trombone player, I actually bonded with a really close friend of mine, met him the very first day I met him. We were at a cigar and scotch meeting, and he was a jazz musician. And the first thing he said was that he had played in Tom Bones Malone's band. And I immediately had to know everything, because I was such a Blues Brothers nerd. So he brought up some pictures and showed me some video of them playing. And it was like, I'm still trying to get him to introduce me to Bones, because I was obsessed with this band. I have, like I said, I have three of their albums on vinyl. I love the music is a big part of it. And I think that the movie is a vehicle for the music, but it's also a vehicle for Saturday Night Live type of humor, which I'm also a fan of. So I enjoy it from start to finish.
And I'm not above, I mean, look, I love Dude, Where's My Car? And that's a movie that's stupid as fuck, right? And
right.
Should only barely be considered art. Like I get it, you know, like I'm not some like highbrow, you know, sophisticate who
right
can't be bothered with the comedy of the hoi polloi. And again, it's not like I didn't enjoy the musical numbers, and it's not like I didn't laugh. I laughed several times. I just, maybe it feels to me like the sum is not greater than the parts for this one. The parts were great. Trying to put them together this way, just kind of, as I look at it linearly as a movie that has a beginning and a middle and an end and should have all of the things that we know of a movie, rising action and plot, and it has some of that stuff. I mean, nothing, I think you can admit nothing particularly groundbreaking, nor does every movie need to be, right? You need a vehicle, like you said, you need a vehicle to get from one performance to another, from one punchline to another, from one gag to another. So, I mean, I get that. It's just for me, it just didn't land. Like it does for others.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's okay to be wrong sometimes. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, it happens every day. I'm used to that.
It's only 7.9 on IMDb. It only is, you know, internationally beloved by everyone. And now I will say this. I will say this. Blues Brothers 2000, which was a semi-sequel because John Belushi, of course, was no longer with us, is a piece of holy trash. I don't think I got 45 minutes in because it beats up on the corpse that the Blues Brothers was. It was Dan Aykroyd's attempt to try to revive it with John Goodman and this little kid as another member of the Blues Brothers, and it's just a pathetic. They bring, you know, more artists back in, but the musical numbers are so annoying because they've got this 12-year-old Blues Brother kid. It was like a Disney Channel version of the Blues Brothers, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I hate that film, and I just won't get into it. Here's just a little picture of the Orange Whips that I mentioned earlier with John Candy. Just a great, great moment. I still love that scene. I still quote that scene. I quote this movie on a regular basis. It's one of those things. But, yeah, so many cameos besides, like, if you watch the end of the film after they go back to prison and they sing Jailhouse Rock and they go through not only the musical artists, but Carrie Fisher, Henry Gibson, Kathleen, Henry Gibson from Laugh-In plays the head Nazi, John Candy, Kathleen Freeman, has so many different, Frank Oz, who is Miss Piggy.
Frank Oz.
And what I love about it, he's Miss Piggy. And then later on when they do the crash through the mall, which is an amazing action sequence, a chase sequence. No one's been able to duplicate a chase scene in a shopping mall. And they do it. It's one of my favorite moments too as well. I like the whole thing, of course. But the guy actually asks, do you have a Miss Piggy? Which Frank Oz was earlier when he's in the Toys R Us and asking for a stuffed animal for his kid. So I think Frank Oz being there in a brief moment, there's so many things that I really like the film. So, and I'll continue to do so.
You should. I mean, it's not like I even know this was going to be an unpopular opinion.
Steven Spielberg as well. Is the clerk that takes the check at the very end, right before all the soldiers march in. Again, this movie is way over the top. The chase scenes, the military, the SWAT teams that assault the building as they go to pay the assessment on the Cook County, and then they end up in jail. And then if you look in the crowd here in the top right, one of the prisoners was Joe Walsh, as a matter of fact, in there as well. Yeah. He has a little cameo that Joe Walsh did. So he has so many different people in it.
Eagles fame.
Of the Eagles, yes.
No, not the Eagles.
Oh, no, not the Eagles. Everybody said, you're right, it's Eagles.
Yeah.
Yeah. My team is the Eagles.
Yeah. And they also suck, just like Eagles do.
What?
No, I went and saw Eagles, and they were amazing. Oh, I went with Jarrett and...
Oh, nice.
And I don't know that I've seen better concerts, but I've never seen a concert where they sounded more like the CDs.
Okay.
That were, it was total fucking pros.
Do you have a lot of their CDs?
I don't like it when you do it. I only like it when I do it.
You know, I want to go see Eagles at the Sphere, but I don't want to have to take out a second mortgage on my house to do it. And now Metallica's coming there, and I'd love to go. But
that's how I felt about Dead and Company out there. But yeah, man, it is not cheap.
No,
so
not for the Sphere. But they're supposed to open another Sphere somewhere else in the U.S. I need, if they could get more of them, then maybe the prices will come down. I don't know.
I heard that they were going to open one in Uranus.
A big, giant, glowing sphere in Uranus.
A big black hole in Uranus.
All right.
Well, so what? I mean, we're going to vote.
We're going to vote. We've talked about both films, and that's how this show works. We debate, and we say why we like one or the other.
Not a debate. We're just talking about them. I'm not trying to convince you of shit.
Oh, that's true. We don't really stand up at a platform and give 5 minutes and then have a rebuttal or anything like that.
Yeah, Lincoln Douglas or whoever his name was.
Yeah, it was Lincoln Douglas, Stephen Douglas. Yeah, you're right. Good job.
Steve Lincoln.
Okay.
I'll debate you on it.
Yeah, nice. All right. So that being said, we're coming down to the part of the show where we actually have to vote. I can go first. I think we both know. We don't even really have to say, do we? I mean, we both know which one we're voting for.
I'm voting for Blues Brothers.
Why? And I'm voting for That Thing You Do. So there.
All right. Well, then what did the audience say?
So, yes. Right now, I'm pretty sure, Eric, you're voting for That Thing You Do, and I'm voting for the Blues Brothers either way. I think this is the first one, this series of battles where we've not agreed. So, and that's fine. It's good for the show to not agree.
Yeah, the people want to hear us disagree. They don't want to hear us disagree the way we did on Caddyshack.
No, but the people do want to.
You know, listen, that was a social experiment.
Yes,
it was just good. Trying something out. It didn't land.
It was good.
I apologize to Greg. We moved on with life. We're not going to do that again. But
it was actually entertaining. I enjoyed that.
I know.
Yeah.
Already that the audience voted for Blues Brothers. They
Did you look it up?
I'm not stupid. So then I knew that I could put my vote with That Thing You Do, and I could vote my conscience.
There you
go.
And
I could vote, you know, for clearly the better of the two movies.
Yeah.
It's not my fault that just like fucking bullshit Beetlejuice that people for whatever reason. No, I'm just kidding. I see way more value to Blues Brothers than I will ever have ever seen for Beetlejuice piece of shit movie. So I knew I could vote. I knew we're going to vote for that. And then the audience would vote with you. And then they can all, just like you, go fuck themselves. And then...
Well, I will say this. We had double-digit votes on this one on the fan page, and by a amount of 63% to 42%, which was fairly close considering.
No.
It was fairly close.
63 to 42? What are you talking about?
It was close.
That doesn't add up to 100.
It doesn't?
63 and 42. That's
105. That's what it said on Facebook. I can only go by what Facebook has. So it would have been 32 then, right? 63 and 32, or what would that?
63 and 37?
Yeah.
Are you talking about percentages?
Let me look at it again. Let me see if I got that wrong. Hold on.
40% of the time.
I'm sorry. I lied. I read it wrong. 36% to 63%. So... With a fraction of
where's
a
the
percent.
Missing 1%?
It's probably on Blues Brothers.
I mean, you tried to make it sound like it was close. It wasn't fucking close.
Okay, it wasn't as close
one.
As I thought. It wasn't as close as I thought. I think I accidentally thumbed my vote onto That Thing You Do and it swayed it in the percentage.
No.
So that might have been what happened. So that I did not unintentionally vote. I do not vote on the fan votes.
No. This is bullshit. I'm not on Facebook, so you have total control, and you can politic for it.
I never do.
Yes, you do. You're on there.
Everybody in the chat.
Everybody dinner.
Mike can in the chat can verify that I do.
Mike hates you anyway.
So I think that without a doubt it confirms which one of this battle is the Blues Brothers tonight. So Round of applause to the Blues Brothers, the movie band's winner over That Thing You Do. And then we move on. That's how it works.
I hate this show when I don't get my way.
So that's three down. We've got one left. Now, possibility we could be back next week for this.
Let's just do it next week.
We could do that. We have to watch these movies over this weekend and enjoy it. If you need these, let me know. I can hook you up. The Five Heartbeats is our next battle. It is a take on the Temptations and their rise to fame, but in a kind of a fake biopic, versus The Commitments, which is another similar to Sing Street, Irish rock band that's formed. This one was done in the early 90s, that this came out, or late 80s, early 90s was when The Commitments came out. So it was Alan Parker film. I think you're going to enjoy The Commitments quite a bit. I think you'll enjoy both of these. I think The Five Heartbeats was a mid-90s film, and I thought it was done extremely well, and it's a really good, both of these are really good musically. I think if you like the Temptation sound, you'll love The Five Heartbeats, and I think you'll like The Commitments as well.
I love that David Ruffin, so I'm in.
Yeah, good stuff.
All right,
well, that's it for this show. I want to just point out we had a great time.
No, we didn't.
Just because Eric did not get his way. But hey, if you love the show, make sure that you tell a friend and recommend them to listen to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Music.
I will not.
Or Amazon Music. And don't forget to check out our live stream on YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast, or on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod, or on our Facebook page.
No.
You can email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. And with that being said, our winner tonight,
not
again,
going to.
Blues Brothers. Over That Thing You Do. We'll be back hopefully next week. That's what we're going to shoot for. And until then, I'm going to leave you with Eric and his parting words.
Yeah, until next time, do whatever, because none of it matters, and life is just pain. So, fuck off.
Just see how he gets when he doesn't win?
Well, this is all still so stupid. Y'all be excellent to each other until next time. You know you gotta do that.
See you in a week or so.